Okay, well, thank you very much, Francisco, for inviting me, and very pleased to be here in such wonderful surroundings. I won't try to explain how this lecture fits into the theme of the conference. I think I'll leave that for you to figure out, and I think this is one of those cases where you only have a sense of how things fit together at the end, so I won't try to prejudge things. Okay, so the topic is, can local culture survive globalization? Well, when I was a small boy growing up in Kuala Lumpur, and I should mention that I'm of Malaysian origin, but of Australian citizenship. Are there any Malaysians in the audience, incidentally? Any Australians in the audience? Okay, just the one. That's underrepresented. Okay, yeah. Collingwood won yesterday or today, so in case you are. When I was a small boy growing up in Kuala Lumpur, I used to enjoy watching the Teh Tarik Man. Now, that's why I asked if there are any Malaysians in the audience, because most of you have probably never heard of the Teh Tarik Man. Okay. So for those of you unfamiliar with this fellow, he's a man who sells hot, sweet, milky tea, which he cools to drinking temperature by pouring the tea from one glass to another. Okay. Now, the tea is nothing special. The fun was really just watching this guy dressed in those days in a checked sarong, a singlet, a cap made from a handkerchief that knotted at each corner, draining this liquid from a great height from one glass to another at considerable speed. And he would do it so expertly and with such showmanship that at times it looked as if the tea was pulled horizontally from one glass to the other. Teh means tea, tarik means pull. Teh tarik, pull tea. What could be simpler? Well, what would become of the Teh Tarik Man in the future? Okay, well, let's see, this is a picture of the Teh Tarik Man as portrayed by the well-known Malaysian cartoonist Lat. Okay, this is the Teh Tarik Man around about 1980. And Lat gave one answer when he drew two panels, one representing Malaysia in the late 1970s, and the other, Malaysia in 2001. The first panel showed the Teh Tarik Man in his sarong, singlet, but you know, without the handkerchief cap, which I remember, stretching a glass of tea diagonally across his torso. Well, it's not quite diagonally, but you know, I remember him almost horizontally. The second showed 2001 AD. Okay, so, it showed a robot, also dressed in a checked sarong, singlet, no head on which to tie a handkerchief cap, doing exactly the same thing. Okay, so this is progress. Okay. But of course, the point is that some things do stay the same. Okay. And I wondered what this answer amounts to, for there are at least a couple of ways of interpreting Lat's cartoon. One is to read it as saying that in the future, local traditions will disappear or exist only in artificial form. Another is to see it as saying that technological progress might bring superficial changes, new methods of delivery, but the core values it will deal in will remain the same. New bottles, but the same old wine or tea. Okay, plus ça change. Okay. But on further reflection, I think Lat's cartoon raises a host of questions. Whether or not the cartoonist himself intended to do so. The general conceptual question is, what exactly does local mean, especially when contrasted with global? Does local mean particular, while global means universal? One normative question is, should we prefer the local to the global, the particular to the universal? Or is the universal more important, or more valuable, or more compelling, morally speaking? How we answer these questions bears on how we might answer other related questions. Should we worry about how the local might be protected from the impact of globalization and the march of universalism? Or is the real problem one of figuring out how to globalize in the face of local resistance? Now, I raise these questions in part because they bear on issues that dominate contemporary political philosophy, which has been particularly concerned with the matter of how to deal with the fact of diversity. ethical, religious, political, and cultural pluralism. But I also raise them because these are issues that are interesting and sometimes troubling in themselves. Philosophers have long been concerned by them because they are questions that cannot be evaded when we consider how to establish or reform the practices, laws, and institutions under which we live, and because they are questions that are inescapable for anyone who reflects on his place in the modern world and on his relations with the great variety of people and practices he will encounter. There is, however, a further reason for my interest in these questions, which has to do with certain facts of biography. I was born in Malaysia shortly after independence, and at that time Singapore was in fact a part of Malaysia, or at least became so very briefly, before it went its separate ways. But having been born in Malaysia, I've really lived most of my life in the West, as a citizen of Australia, and also as a resident in various times of the United States and the United Kingdom. In Malaysia, I was raised to think of myself as Malaysian, but a Ceylonese Tamil Malaysian, since my parents and relatives had only recently acquired citizenship and a political stake in Malaysia. But now I do not think of myself as Malaysian, and even less as a Ceylonese or Sri Lankan. I carry an Australian passport. I flash my Chris Fly or my Qantas frequent flyer card at airport check-in counters as a valuable member of the Star Alliance or the One World system. And I reside in Crystal Palace, London, by the grace of a 5-year working visa. Now, I remember a letter my mother wrote to me when I was a student, when she quoted her father quoting Sir Walter Scott. Why on earth she was quoting Sir Walter Scott, I have no idea. But anyway, this is in a letter to me when I was a student. "Breathes there the man with soul so dead, who never to himself hath said, this is my own, my native land." Okay? This is from Scott's epic poem, Lay of the Last Minstrel, though the stanza really comes from a separate, or the stanza's best known as a separate poem going by the title, My Native Land. So here's my mother quoting her father, expressing his feeling for his first home, which was the Jaffna Peninsula of Sri Lanka, which he left forever when he was 20, around about 1920, in fact. Now, despite my affection for Australia and Malaysia, I've never really had any such feeling for any place. For 40 years, I've returned home to Malaysia almost every year, and each time I've left Malaysia to return home to Australia. In a few weeks' time, I will return home from Turkey to London. So I wonder if there's any place that would recognize me as a local. Yet, if I am nowhere a local, I cannot help also wondering, what is the perspective that I hold, apart from the fact that my perspective is true, which I've always felt? Is it global? Is it universal? Or is it, to borrow a phrase from the American philosopher Thomas Nagel, a view from nowhere? Another American philosopher, John Rawls, reflecting on the problem of identifying the true principles of justice in the world, in which advocates from so many different viewpoints advance such a diverse array of principles, suggested that the solution lay in finding a uniquely viable perspective from which to look at the world. If we could see the world from a standpoint from which we could not be partial to our particular local identities, one in which we were stripped of our particular attachments and interests, we would surely see what justice demanded. "Purity of heart, if one could attain it," he wrote, "would be to see clearly and act with grace and self-command from this point of view." But shorn of my original identity and with a tenuous attachment to any locality, I find myself doubting that I've come any closer to grasping what justice demands or commands universally, and wondering whether there is any universal standpoint in questions of morality and politics. Yet while my personal history might supply some of the motivation for my inquiries, it doesn't provide the purpose. My purpose here is to take a critical look at the very idea that there are universal values and finding or converging upon them is highly desirable. Now, this is an abiding concern of many liberal political philosophers who ask how universal values might be better promoted in the world. Some write about the problem of how to liberalize cultures. Others write about how to democratize nations and establish norms of global justice. I want to ask some questions about the justifiability of such aspirations. But equally, I want to look critically at the defenders of the local and to ask what attitude we should take to the particular, even as we cast a skeptical eye on the universal. So let me turn to the question of the idea of a universal perspective by going back in history to a point when modern Europeans first became seriously interested and exercised by the challenge posed by human diversity. Between 1538 and 1539, Friar Francisco de Vitoria, Master of Theology and Professor at the University of Salamanca in Spain, delivered two lectures, the first on dietary laws, dealing with Aquinas' treatment of cannibalism, and the second on the conquest of the Americas and the rights of the Spanish monarchy to rule over the Indians in civil, religious, and spiritual matters. It had been 20 years since Hernán Cortés first arrived in Mexico to begin the destruction of the Aztec Empire under Montezuma II and establish Spanish rule. And even as Vitoria was preparing his lectures, a later conquistador, Francisco Pizarro, was in the process of subduing the Inca Empire, having won Spanish approval in 1529 to conquer the region and become viceroy. By 1539, Spain had established settlements in the Caribbean islands and in Mexico, and the immigrants who now populated them had grown used to the wealth they enjoyed under terms that entitled them to enslave members of the working of the native population to work the land. But the question this provoked in Spain, particularly in its universities, was whether the conquest and the subjugation of the Indians was defensible. It was a question that would eventually prompt the first king of Spain, Charles I, who was also Charles V, the Holy Roman Emperor, to consider withdrawing from the New World altogether on the grounds of the immorality of conquest. When Charles asked that the question be formally considered in a debate before the crown at Valladolid in 1550, the two leading protagonists, Bartolomé de las Casas, defending the Indians, and Juan Ginés de Sepúlveda, defending the right of conquest, appealed to the writings of Vitoria to bolster their competing argument. Now, Vitoria wrote and delivered his lectures at a time when Spain was divided on the question of the justice of conquest, the rationality of the Indians, and the legitimacy of Christianization. The crown and great numbers of Spanish adventurers wanted to remain in the New World. Gold had been discovered in Hispaniola, Cuba, and Peru, and there was silver in Mexico. In 1537, in his bull Sublimus Deus, Pope John III had granted Spain and the Church rights to the New World and asserted that both had a Christianizing mission. Reports from missionaries about the cruel treatment and exploitation of the Indians provoked anxiety and even outrage in some quarters, but the spoils of conquest were too great for these reservations to lead to changes in policy. Vitoria, however, looked at the moral issues of conquest not as an interested adventurer, but as a disinterested academic. He began with a seemingly innocent question: whether it is lawful to baptize the children of unbelievers against the wishes of parents. Answering this question, he thought, required establishing whether barbarians, as they were called, had dominion over their lands, examining the question of how the Spanish could acquire title to those lands, and considering the implications if the Spanish could not acquire just title. Did the Indians have dominion? There were four possible reasons why barbarians might not be true masters in Vitoria's view. First, that they were sinners. Second, that they were unbelievers. Third, that they were madmen. Or four, that they were insensate, like beasts. None of these reasons he thought defensible. Even if Indians were sinners, they did not lose civil rights of ownership or dominion over themselves. If they were heretics, which was implausible, not even heretics forfeited rights of ownership. To say that they were mad was also implausible, since they had order, marriage, magistrates, and commerce, all of which require reason. And it was not their fault that they were born outside of civilization and were unaware of the need to seek baptism. And if the Indians seemed slow-witted, it was not that they were insensate, just uneducated, like Spain's peasants. So how could Spain acquire possession of the Indians' lands? According to Vitoria, it was not within the emperor's right to assert that he was master of the world, since this was clearly false. Nor could the Pope make any such claim, for his authority was confined to spiritual matters involving Christians. He had no spiritual jurisdiction over infidels, nor any temporal power over them. The Indians were bound to listen to Christian teachings and to believe them if the arguments were persuasive. But unless the Spanish could offer persuasive arguments accompanied by miracles, signs, and displays of exemplary virtue by Christians themselves, the Indians were not obliged to believe them. Even if the Indians committed sins of cannibalism, incest, and sodomy, Vitoria argued, Christian princes had no authority to compel them to give up their sins because they had no jurisdiction over them. What then could the Spanish do to acquire dominion? In Vitoria's judgment, quite a lot. They could seek out partnerships with Indians, for the Spanish had the right to travel and dwell in those lands, and the barbarians had no right to prevent mutual intercourse or trade. Nor could they bar the Spanish from things held in common or deny their children the right to take up Spanish citizenship. The Spanish also had the right to convert people, even against their will, but not by force, the right to defend the innocent against tyranny, and right to take sides in wars between barbarian groups. If the barbarians behaved like children, it might even be defensible for the Spanish to take over administration of them for their own good, though not for the good of the Spanish. Vitoria was prepared to admit that if the Spanish were unable to acquire just title and the barbarians did not want them there, the Spanish would simply have to accept the loss. But he was quick to reassure the emperor that trade would not have to cease, only conquest. He also advised the crown that their revenues need not diminish, for all that would be necessary was higher taxes on merchants. But if large numbers of Indians were converted, there would be no need to abandon rule of the territories of the New World. Now, it's not difficult to be impressed by the intelligence and honesty of Vitoria's reasoning, and also by the humanity of his stance. At a time when many of his countrymen were interested only in enriching themselves in the Americas, he presented a view that asserted the moral equality of all human beings and insisted that the natives of the New World had rights. Thus, he insisted that forcible conversion was indefensible and that coercion of non-believers was an injustice because it took away their liberty. If those who have been preached to refused to believe it, it would be wrong to throw down their temples or smash their idols, for this is an injury to their rights. Central to Vitoria's outlook was a view of the humanity of the Indians. And those like Sepúlveda, who tried in the 1540s to argue otherwise, found themselves discredited in the universities of Spain. The more inclusive attitudes of Vitoria and of the Dominican friar and advocate for the Indians, Las Casas, dominated and won the moral debate. Yet, impressed though one might be by the moral stature of such figures, it nonetheless bears noting that the alternative they did not take seriously was the possibility of trying to understand the Indians and their traditions in their own terms, or simply leaving them alone. The concern of the Spanish theologians was to settle the issue of whether the natives of the New World had rights. What was not at issue for them was what rights there were, nor were they concerned with the question of whether the natives were bound by the demands of morality, for everyone was. What morality required could be understood, or at least discovered, by appropriate investigation by rational beings. This universal morality was binding on all. Emperors and princes, and for that matter, popes, were limited in what they could do only because they lacked political authority to act beyond their own jurisdictions. But native peoples had no right to refuse to trade, or to deny the Spanish the freedom to enter their lands, or to decline to listen to the preaching of the gospel. They had no right to decline an invitation to join the one moral community, for whether they liked it or not, they were a part of it and subject to its laws. For Vitoria and those who thought like him, the question was how to deal justly with distant peoples, and also how to Christianize them. Now, it's important to be fair to Vitoria here, for he was not an advocate of conquest, nor did he think it justifiable to make war upon other peoples, either to convert them to Christianity or to force them to give up immoral practices, such as anthropophagy, that is to say, eating human flesh, and human sacrifice. Even though he has demonstrated that anthropophagy and human sacrifice are wrong, Vitoria maintains that unless nations can be convinced by manifest proofs of the evil of their actions, they cannot be judicially condemned, and punishment cannot be meted out without prior condemnation. At the same time, Vitoria does not suggest that intervention is never impermissible or never permissible. Christian princes can declare war on barbarians for practicing human sacrifice, not because human sacrifice is wrong in itself, but because those who are sacrificed are the victims of injustice or injury and have rights to defend themselves. If they may defend themselves, others, including Christian princes, have the right to come to their defense. Otherwise, Christians cannot make war. Yet having established this exception to the prohibition on conquest, Vitoria reasons as follows. It is lawful to defend an innocent even if he does not ask us to, or even if he refuses our help, for in some matters he cannot renounce his rights. No one can give another the right to kill him. Besides, many of the victims may be children. He then goes on to say of some of the Indians that it is a fact that these barbarians kill innocent men, at least for sacrifice, and that therefore princes may wage war against them to force them to give up their rituals. Finally, he notes that even if the natives sacrifice criminals to eat, they still commit an injustice, since the law of nations, indeed a natural law, says that the bodies of the dead are exempt from this injustice. In a few sentences, he moves from a prohibition on waging interventionist war, except to come to the aid of a third party acting in self-defense, to a defense of war in case children need rescue or if the dead are dishonored. He goes on to say that if the only method of ensuring safety is by setting up Christian princes over the barbarians, that also would be lawful. It would also be lawful to declare war on them if they refuse to give preachers, or if they refuse to receive preachers of Christianity. Finally, if a Christian prince becomes a prince of pagans by whatever means, he may then compel them to accept Christian law and abolish their rituals. Whether because they are natural or for any other reason. Such a prince could not favor his Christian subjects over his pagan ones, for all must be treated equally, and there is no warrant for forced conversion or religious persecution, but their freedom can only be sustained within the limits of the laws of a Christian prince. He says, pains must be taken to instruct and teach them of the empty falsehood of their law and rituals. By industrious effort, they are to be induced to listen to the holy law of Christ, by reasoning brought to see its probability and the improbability of the law under whose deceptions they lead their lives. It will even be lawful to apply a little force in moderate doses to get them to abandon their rituals. A gentle nudge is all that's needed, for where's the harm in a nudge? Thus, in a few sentences, Vittoria appears to take back nearly everything he has rejected in his repudiation of the morality of conquest. Even in the account of a critic of conquest, the advocate of the rights of Indians in the Americas, the rights of conquest enjoyed by European princes are substantial indeed. But perhaps more importantly still, it is only European princes who could justly wage wars of conquest, for the practices of the barbarians were contrary to natural law and inconsistent with the laws of nations. Judged by the standards of universal morality, the natives of the New World could not lay any claim to ruling over Europeans, but Europeans could legitimately come to rule over barbarians in light of their access to the universal truths of morality. Now, Vittoria's influence in the development of modern international law has been extensively discussed, and I'm not going to go over it here. For those interested, Anthony Ungi has argued very persuasively that the philosophical roots of the mandate system of the League of Nations and the institutions established at Bretton Woods at the end of World War II are to be found in Vittoria's writings. And I refer you to Ungi's book, Imperialism, Sovereignty, and the Making of International Law, Cambridge of 2005. But my interest is less in Vittoria's historical influence than in the way in which arguments that purport to serve universal values can so quickly turn into claims that protect particular parochial attitudes and interests. How could Vittoria go from thinking that the Indians of the New World were true masters with dominion over themselves and their property to concluding that it would be lawful for Christian princes to rule over them? Even if he did think that Christian princes should rule justly. The obvious answer is that Vittoria's perspective, capacious and inclusive though it was of all humanity, was a particular rather than a universal one. It was not a global perspective on the place of the Indians in the world, but a European Christian view of the nature of the globe and the place of the Indians in it. The perspective of Christian Europe, or more correctly, perhaps, Catholic theology and natural law just was the universal perspective. Vittoria thought he saw the world from the perspective of universal natural law, but in fact he saw it from a position in 16th century Spain. From the perspective of non-Christians and non-Europeans, this seems highly unsatisfactory. It also raises the obvious question, can there be a universal standpoint from which questions of morality or questions of value can be decided? Is there a global point of view? There's been no shortage of people who believe there is, from philosophers down the ages to contemporaries who argue that we have reached the end of history, Fukuyama, or who think we have now a universal civilization, think of V.S. Naipaul. But perhaps there really is no such thing as a universal point of view. The particular frequently masquerades as the universal, but remove the mask and the particular will be revealed. But perhaps this is too quick. To consider the question more closely, we should ask what exactly it means to say that some standpoint is universal. A perspective might be thought universal because it is not confined to a particular place or region. Universal here contrasts with local. On the other hand, universal might be used to indicate that a perspective is not temporary or fleeting, but permanent or even eternal. Universal here contrasts with current. Here's one way of looking at that contrast, okay, representing these possibilities diagrammatically. In one case, universal contrasts with local, understood as current. In another case, the universal is represented in the eternal or the permanent. So how do we think about these alternatives? More particularly, are there any perspectives that really do fit into categories B and D? The best way to think about this question is to think what values we might put into these different boxes. The perspective of the Te Tariq man is perhaps one example of a local perspective. Okay? It's the perspective of the man on the street, and on the street in his own society. His concerns and outlook are likely to be parochial and informed by consideration of current condition or circumstances. He's a local, but he also thinks about the here and now. His concern is unlikely to be the interest. Similarly, the perspective of someone like a European farmer is likely to be local and current. His concern is unlikely to be interest of farmers everywhere or the farmers of the future, but farmers like him and now. This farmer thinks about the local and he thinks about his current circumstances. I don't think anyone has ever accused a European farmer of being a universalist, and I doubt that this has ever been claimed by the farmers themselves. The farmer and the Te Tariq man belong in box A. The perspective of a country or a state is also local, since states are usually concerned about their own interests above all others. But it might be that their time horizons are more distant than those of the man in the street. The state looks at matters from the point of view of its interests in the long run, and that may extend over many generations. So the perspective of Australia, for example, would belong in box C, since the Australian state would look to its own interests over the long run. Okay, it's still local, but it's permanent, perhaps even eternal. Okay. In a somewhat different way, the perspective of a tradition like Judaism is similar, since its standpoint is that of a particular people with a covenant with God, and its perspective is a long run, perhaps in this case really an eternal one. Who then has a universal perspective? Perhaps the perspective of a modern transnational corporation could be viewed as universal to the extent that its interests encompass those of people around the globe. But its perspective is likely to be limited to the extent that its concerns will always be dominated by the interests of current shareholders. So corporations like IBM belong in box B, universal and global, but current. The same thing goes for international organizations like the World Bank or the United Nations. Though their perspective is global to some extent, bearing in mind that they're dominated by particular national states, they act in accordance with the immediate interests of existing member states. Now the question then is this: is there a universal perspective that is universal in some larger sense? Is there a standpoint that it is both universal or global and permanent or eternal? Is there a standpoint of humanity? Is it possible to look at the world, as some philosophers have suggested, sub specie eternitatis, under the aspect of eternity? Vittoria thought that one could by understanding the world in terms of natural law. Defenders of different religious traditions see their doctrines as having universal standing in this broad sense. And some modern writers have seen the theory of liberal democracy as a perspective that embodies the final stage of historical development towards a permanent, global, or universal moral standard. But my thought is that there may be no universal, global, permanent, or eternal perspective on the world. And the search for or assertion of the existence of one is just a mistake. Box D should really be empty. There is no universal standpoint and there are no universal values. Now, one obvious reaction towards this claim would be that this is just overstated. Okay. There must be some elements of morality that hold everywhere and for all time. The problem is to discover what these are, and it's important not to give up too easily. After all, don't we consider some sorts of goods everywhere to be valuable? Justice, friendship, freedom, happiness, love. Surely these are universal and eternal goods. Well, I have two worries here. The first is that even those who are trying their best to look at the world from a universal standpoint cannot help but see it through the lenses of their own. They will see the world the way they've been taught to see it and the way they've grown used to seeing it. Even as they try to view the world from a less partial perspective, they will, like Vittoria, end up smuggling into their reasoning the assumptions they find unremarkable, but which others find strange or untrue. This cartoon is from the New Yorker. The second and related worry is that the only way to defend the idea of universal values or a universal perspective is to make it so general and abstract that it loses all content. To say that the standpoint of natural law is the right perspective from which to view the world may make sense, but only if it meant something so broad that it became almost meaningless and entirely uncontentious. It would be like saying that the right point of view is the moral point of view. It does not get any better if one appeals to particular values as universal, justice, for example, or friendship, or the pursuit of happiness, which V.S. Naipaul suggested is a universal value bequeathed to the modern world by the Declaration of Independence by the West. That justice, friendship, and happiness are important values everywhere is hard to deny, but the issue is what they mean, and they mean quite different things in different places and traditions. Consider the value of friendship, to take just one example. Okay? In many Western societies, friendship is understood in terms that have been analyzed by an array of thinkers, from Aristotle to Montaigne to C.S. Lewis. But this notion is understood by all of these figures in terms laid down by the pattern of relationships that exist in societies dominated by nuclear families, commercial civil societies, and norms of individual independence. But consider what friendship means in a society such as that of the Yolngu of Northern Australia, where relations are shaped profoundly by the most important element of social organization there, the kinship system. In this society, there are certain people who just cannot be friends. A man and his mother-in-law must avoid each other completely and must never address one another directly. When I heard this, I thought I should become a Yolngu. A man and his sisters and classificatory sisters cannot be friends. Some people, on the other hand, are supposed to be friends. Friendship cannot exist in this tradition outside the network of kinship, and those who are not kin are mulkuru, strangers. To become a friend, one must enter that system by adoption, or in the case of other Aboriginals, find out what relationship they would have if they were kin. There are relationships here that we might wish to describe as friendship, but those relationships are not like those denoted by the term in our own societies. It might be possible to say in these circumstances that friendship is a universal value, but the concept of friendship is now picking up quite different things in different places. If this is the case, nothing much is gained by asserting that friendship is a universal value. I think we can say much the same thing about many other values, from justice to freedom to happiness. This is not to say that we should abandon the use of these notions or to suggest that anyone can use them in any way he pleases. It is simply to insist that appealing to universal values or some universal standpoint just won't get us very far. At times, one suspects that those who proclaim the universality of values to which they appeal, or of the perspective from which they see things, are really making a strategic move to bolster the appeal of the very particular interests or points of view that they hold. This can be as true of those who appeal to their religion as it can be of those who appeal to other ethical and political ideals. Now, it may appear from all that I've said in my skeptical appraisal of the universal point of view. The advocate says to the judge, "Your Honor, I didn't realize, I assumed the law here was the same as in New Jersey. As you may know, dog eat dog is permissible there. So it's not enough to show that one way of doing things is good or right just because it's the way we do things around here. A part of the reason for this is that even locals must recognize that they live in a larger world in which a variety of ways of thinking and valuing press up against one another. To be local is not to be isolated. What I have in mind here is not so much the way that the forces of global commerce and the international community might land on the doorstep of a small nation, but the fact that even within a country, there can be large differences. The lives and outlooks of the Aboriginal people of Arnhem Land are very different from those of the inhabitants of Sydney, who may have more in common with the citizens of Singapore. Okay. You can't really see that very well, but that's a photo that I took in Vietnam at a travel agent. It's one of those HSBC commercials contrasting global and local. Okay. And what you're supposed to see is a bowl of noodle soup and a hamburger. One context, one is global and the other is local, and then the other case it's reversed. So localness is a matter of degree. Okay. So it will not do to appeal to the local as a decisive reason for anything. For the immediate question will be, who are these fellow locals? Are they your neighbors, or your fellow city dwellers, or your countrymen? In the end, even locals will have from time to time to take a larger perspective. I think globally, but I spend locally. That's very apt for these troubled financial times. They will have to step into someone else's shoes to try to see the world from some other point of view. But stepping into someone else's shoes requires more than simply stepping out of one's own. Running around barefoot is no substitute, even if some think that being shoeless gives one a universal perspective on things. The conclusion to which I'm working then is that what we should be striving for in our relations with others, particularly in politics, is not to find the correct point of view or even a common point of view, but to see each other's point of view. What we should be seeking is not universality, but mutuality. This is not to say that we should look uncritically at one another or other societies, or that we can never condemn anything. It's rather to emphasize that we should not be looking for that unique perspective, that universal point of judgment from which all matters could be settled. So what then is the answer to the question, can local culture survive globalization? And what, some of you may be wondering, will become of the Te Tariq man? Okay. But my answer is that it cannot help but survive because the local is always with us. It is an inescapable aspect of the way things are. All relations are local relations, or relations among people from particular localities. This is the point I take from Lutz's cartoon. But the local cannot be isolated or remain unchanged. One day we will wake up and find that the Te Tariq man has gone on to other things. And I think this is the point where I stop and call for questions.